This is March 3rd, and for Teisho this morning, I'm going to undertake quite an ambitious project, which is to outline some of the main points of one of the great Mahayana sutras, the Lankavatara Sutra. And I say ambitious because, several reasons, one of which is that the what has come down to us as the sutra is quite disorganized. Reading here from D.T. Suzuki in his book Studies in the Lankavatara Sutra, he says, "The whole Lankavatara is just a collection of notes unsystematically strung together, and, frankly speaking, it is a useless task to attempt to divide them into sections or chapters under some specific titles." But that that is what is done in the text, the main text I'll be using, which is a new English translation of the Lankavatara Sutra by Red Pine. That's his the name he uses as an author. His actual name is Bill Porter. He's translated quite a few books: Zen Baggage, Zen Hermits of China, and other books that some of you may have read or heard about. But this is his latest, I think. And he says in his own introduction that he postponed tackling this sutra for years and years and years because it is so very difficult, both in how disorganized it is and how subtle and sophisticated it is. It's probably the most psychological of the sutras, the Mahayana sutras. Just a word about Mahayana sutras. There are six. Let me back up again. There are two main streams of Buddhism. There's what's called the Theravada Buddhism, which is largely in Southeast Asian countries and always has been. It's also sometimes called early Buddhism. And then there's the Mahayana Buddhism, which Zen is a part of. Mahayana Buddhism is found not in Southeast Asia, but in Japan, China, Tibet, Korea, and a little bit in Vietnam as well. The main six Mahayana sutras are the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Platform Sutra, the Sarangama Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, and this, the Lankavatara Sutra. And although there is one other translation that I'm aware of that came out years ago of parts of the Lankavatara Sutra, this one seems to be much more authoritative, this new one by Red Pine. It has a lot of commentary in it, a lot of clarification of these terms that are used in the sutra. D.T. Suzuki, in his book Studies in the Lankavatara Sutra, also says, "The Lankavatara is a very difficult specimen of literature, and it requires a great deal of scholarship to read and understand it intelligently." Hence, my use of the word ambitious in trying to bring this to light to some extent this morning in 45 minutes. Hardy har har. Let me start with just a way that D.T. Suzuki summarizes his. The principal thesis of the Lankavatara may be regarded as summarized in the following passage. And then he quotes the Buddha directly from the sutra. This is the Buddha addressing one of his chief disciples, Mahamati. All things have no self-substance. There's no intrinsic permanent entity of anything. Everything is in flux. All things have no self-substance. They are like a cloud, like a circle traced out by a revolving firebrand, or like the air castle of the Gandharvas, that they are unborn, that they are like Maya, or Maya means illusion. They are like Maya or mirage, or the moon and water, or a dream, that external objects are manifestations of the mind erroneously perceived due to false discrimination since time immemorial, that by thus viewing the world one ceases to be conditioned by the false discrimination. That is, if we come to see the world as illusion, basically, as projections of our own mind, one does away with the terminology belonging to such false discrimination. I won't continue. It's pretty conceptual as it goes on. But to make it even more simple, the thesis of the Lankavatara Sutra is that whatever we perceive is the projection of our own mind. Everything is mind. Everything is our own mind. Another way it's been expressed is beyond mind there are no objects, or we could say outside of mind there is no world, and beyond the world there is no mind. And this fundamental truth will be familiar to some of you from one of our chants, Affirming Faith in Mind, where there's a pair of lines in there. It says, for things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. This affirming faith in mind was attributed to the third Zen patriarch, Sun Tzu, who was the Dharma grandson of Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, according to the scholarship, when he transmitted the Dharma to his successor, Wei Ko, he gave him the Lankavatara Sutra and said, everything you need to know is here. Which is, you could also say, everything you need to know is that there's nothing apart from mind. Let me start by sketching out what appears in this sutra, throughout the sutra, over and over, is where the Buddha is articulating this matter of consciousness and what came to be known as the eight consciousnesses or forms of consciousness. I've said this before in more than a few teishos, but it took me a long time to understand it, so I'm just going to go through it one more time with the advantage of having quite a few references to it in this Lankavatara Sutra. So in Buddhist psychology, the first, what are called the first five consciousnesses are the sensory forms of consciousness. So seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching. These five could be also called sometimes the perceiving consciousness, the five forms of perceiving or sensory consciousness. That's simple enough. The sixth consciousness is the conceptual consciousness. This is where thinking gets into it, this is what conceptualizes the data or the information of the five senses. The seventh consciousness is the real troublemaker. It's sometimes called self-consciousness. It's been defined as sometimes as the will, the traditional word is manas, M-A-N-A-S, or mano-vijnana, manas consciousness. Manas means to reason or reflect or consider. And this is where we really create delusion for ourselves when we through this self-consciousness, where we create, this is the sort of, is considered the seat of the ego, this seventh consciousness. And the eighth is, in the text, it's just called mind, but it has two aspects to it. This mind is also called the storehouse consciousness, or the repository consciousness. And what's important about the Lankavatara Sutra, I mean, other sutras talk about this storehouse consciousness, but the Lankavatara Sutra sees it as having a dual aspect to it. In its defiled aspect, it is just the repository of all habit energy that we have generated by through starting with the senses. The senses and the conceptualizing of the senses, and then the self-consciousness. All of this deposits habit forces into the storehouse consciousness, and yet this storehouse consciousness is in itself, in its pure or undifferentiated aspect, is called the womb of the Buddhas. This is its pure, absolutely pure aspect. I'm going to read again from Studies in the Lankavatara Sutra by Suzuki. So this storehouse or repository consciousness is a kind of mental receptacle where all the memory of one's past deeds and psychic activities is deposited and preserved in a form of energy called vasana, or habit energy. But as this energy is so contaminated with ignorance and wrong judgments and all sorts of attachment, it reacts upon an external world in a way detrimental to the realization of nirvana, and therefore to the perception of the truth. The old conditions must now be overhauled in order to create a new situation in our consciousness. So this may sound so far kind of awfully conceptual, and what's it got to do with practice? Oh, it has everything to do with practice, because it has implications for every second of the use of our mind. Going back to those first five consciousnesses, seeing, hearing, and so forth, that just the direct experience of hearing, let's take one of the senses, it's the same with all five of them. Let's take hearing, because I think this is what is most obvious when we're doing Zazen. There's the sound. So the sound, let's say, of a cough. on the other side of the Zendo. That's just the what the Japanese call first Nen, N-E-N. That's the first thought moment. Just can't even be called a thought. It's very difficult to translate. It's just that perception, hearing, the cough. There it is. And if we could just leave it at that and keep our mind present, then this is the way to purify this storehouse consciousness. But instead, what happens is first the thinking mind comes in, the conceptualizing consciousness. Remember number six consciousness conceptualizes the data of the five senses, and then we're off and running. So a cough, and then what could come next? I wonder if that person's coming down with something, or I hope no one is disturbed by that sound, or anything. You make up your own idea. What could be the thought that immediately follows the sound of a cough? Or let's go outside the Zendo. The sound of a car driving by. That's the simple, direct experience. That's what we want to be tuned into in Zen practice. But instead, because of the force of habit for not just years, decades, but lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes, because of the habit energy that we have built up, our mind tends to flee into associations about the sound of the car. And this all happens with incredible speed, millionths of a second probably. So the sound of the car, shoom, and then, something gets added to that, and then that leads to something else, and then something else, and something else, and something else. And before long, we are off on a train of thought, and we've lost our presence of mind. And meanwhile, all those thoughts that we're having, that chain of thoughts, is being deposited into this storehouse consciousness. And so that that then becomes, they become seeds. The seeds of all that give rise to this whole cycle of what we call karma. That means that we're more likely again. Every time we do that, we're more likely to do it again. Habit energy. But if instead of going off in the train of thought like that, if we can just hear, just see, just smell, taste, touch, or even just think, when we need to think, when we're solving some kind of a problem, we use our brains. If we can do so just simply, then we don't generate that habit energy, and this is what then eventually purifies this storehouse consciousness. So I'm turning to the Lankavatara Sutra, translated by Red Pine, and to the words of the Buddha. This storehouse consciousness, by the way, is the original word is the Tathagata Garbha, but to just keep it simple, I'm just going to say storehouse consciousness. This is the Buddha. The storehouse consciousness is the cause of whatever is good or bad and is responsible for every form of existence everywhere. It is like an actor who changes appearances in different settings but who lacks a self or what belongs to a self. Because this is not understood, followers of other paths unwittingly imagine an agent responsible for the effects that arise from this threefold combination. It's the person who is sensing the object that is being sensed and the act of sensing. So he's saying that the notion of a self as an agent, that is an entity that causes things to happen, is a delusion. It's a projection of our own mind. This is where it's so hard to. If you believe that, then it's very hard to get your mind around the concept of God as an agent, someone with power to do things. But he continues, when the storehouse consciousness is impregnated by the habit energy of beginningless fabrications, it is not fabrications meaning the illusion of self and other, for example, the illusion of things as separate. It is known as the repository consciousness and gives birth to fundamental ignorance along with seven kinds of consciousness. It is like the ocean whose waves rise without cease, but it transcends the misconception of impermanence or the conceit of a self and is essentially pure and clear. So this is the dual nature of the storehouse consciousness. In its essential nature, it is absolutely pure. But then when it is impregnated by all the stuff that's going on all the time in our minds, then it becomes this something very different. The seven kinds of thoughts of the other forms of consciousness, that's consciousnesses 1 through 7, rise and cease as the result of mistakenly projecting and grasping external appearances. Because people are attached to the names and appearances of all kinds of shapes, they are unaware that such forms and characteristics are the perceptions of their own minds, and that bliss or suffering do not lead to liberation. These are mind states. As they become enveloped by names and appearances, their desires arise and create more desires, each becoming the cause or condition of the next. So, names and appearances. This is, just to clarify, this is when we become attached to names and appearances, then become deceived by the nature of reality, because there are different names for everything: altar, candles, fire, trees, Jennifer, Justin. We assign these names, and then we all too easily believe that all these different things are separate, and that's what creates so much trouble. It's if it weren't for language and all these different words, then we'd be less likely to see things as separate. And these are just languages just created by us. Therefore, Mahamati, bodhisattvas who seek the highest goal should purify what are called the storehouse consciousness, the Tathagata Garbha, the womb of the Buddhas, and this repository consciousness. Mahamati, although this repository consciousness of the womb of the Buddha, seen by the minds of Buddhas, is essentially pure, because it is obscured by the dust of sensation, it appears impure. So that's the dual nature of this repository consciousness. And a long time ago, the Buddha himself came up with this analogy of the ocean and the waves. It's going to just be less. I'm offering a less conceptual way of understanding all this. We've often said here in Taisho that if you look at the just mind as having two aspects, our silent, essential nature, unchanging, then that's sort of the depths of the ocean. And then our discriminating mind, mind with a small m, this conceptual mind, is the waves at the surface of the ocean. We can't say that the waves and the depths of the ocean are separate. Of course they're not. It's all water. But we can, at the same time, say they're not exactly the same. So that's a very common enough analogy used in Buddhism. But here it becomes further articulated when we can see that the water represents the repository consciousness, the depths, this eighth consciousness. The movement of water represents the seventh consciousness, that's the self-consciousness, and the waves represent this conceptual consciousness, that's number six, and the wind is that of externality, being attached to names and forms that we think of as not self. There's a wonderful phrase here that the Buddha, regarding we ignorant beings, said, or the ones in his audience, his assembly, he saw the thoughts of those in the assembly stirred by the wind of externality and rising like so many waves in the oceans of their repository consciousness. So then the phrase, to quiet the wind of thought. This is our work. When we do that, when we allow the mind to settle, then we're not pouring all this stuff into the storehouse consciousness and in doing so creating karma that will then just cycle back around. He also says here, the Buddha says, lost in projections, they become captives of the actors and actions of their own minds. I think a good rendering of this idea of everything is the projections of our own mind, a contemporary modern word would be conditioning, that we don't see things as they are, we don't see people as they are, we don't see events as they are, we don't see objects as they are, but we see them through the prism of the conditioning of our minds, our conditioning. And some obvious examples of this are, discrete example is the unreliability of eyewitnesses. We're discovering, to the shock of many of us, that the Innocence Project now has, last I heard, there are 230 cases of those who were convicted of murder who were later exonerated because of DNA testing, and that most of those 230 wrongfully convicted people were convicted on the basis of eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony is incredibly unreliable. because of just what we're talking about. We project onto people and things our own colorations of our own mind, our own prejudices, our own conditioning. Another thing that I thought of with this thing of what we perceive is the just the projection of our own mind is the placebo effect. They're finding absolutely astonishing things about the placebo effect. We've known for years that those who are administered placebos can show as much improvement sometimes in some studies as those who get actual active medicine. So that's pretty amazing in itself. But more recent study that I ran across was that even when the group receiving the placebos were told they were placebos, they got better. And there's so many. Look at the way. If you've happened to notice, I have myself, the way that we project our ideas on. Here are some examples. The government. There are people. Most of us know. People who see government in the most negative way, only that, just meddling, trying to subjugate us, tyrannical, all these insane things that people say about the government. Not that there aren't aspects of that where we could see as a misuse of power and authority, but there are those who see it purely in those terms. And then there are those who see it in a very different way. Police, depending on our experiences with the police, we may see them as serving us, as protecting us, or we may see them as oppressing or mistreating us. Same thing with the president, Obama. Or previous presidents, doesn't matter. But look at the outrageous notions that people can project onto Obama, or our notions about the poor, our notions about the rich, our notions about the military, our notions about teachers, one's own teacher. This, in psychological terms, is called transference. Where we transfer onto the teacher the experiences or a conditioning based on our experiences in the past, sometimes with mom and dad. And this is part of what a teacher, like a police or the government or the president or others, have to deal with, is being the target of all of these projections, better and worse. Teacher is... receives positive transference and negative transference, both. And of course, I'm not only talking about spiritual teachers, but school teachers have to endure all kinds of crazy things. So these are just little, ordinary, everyday examples of that I think make it pretty clear to what extent that we human beings project our what is in our mind onto what we call the world out there. I remember the day when I suddenly caught myself. For many, many years, most of my life up to, I don't know, age 50, when I was driving out in the country and see these little houses out in the middle of nowhere, I realized one day that I always imagine that in such idyllic ways. How wonderful to be away out of the city and just in the quiet, and a little family gathered around a fire and, you know, eating dinner together. And I mean, not, this was half conscious. I just had a warm feeling whenever I was out in back roads and see these farmhouses and these little houses here and there. And then one day I realized, wait a minute, how do I know that everything is so nice in those houses? Then, you know, the abuse, the physical abuse, sexual abuse, alcoholism, and all that stuff that can happen out in those. And I realized that this projection of mine had been based on largely positive experiences in myself, because we grew up in the woods, more or less, in our family, and we had our problems, but that's where it came from. And how sobering to suddenly realize. So now, the trick is here's the problem, is that we're doing this all the time without knowing it. We don't see. I mean, like the idea of the fish. The fish does not know it's in water. That's all it's ever known. So we are, to some degree, unconscious of all these projections until we become conscious of them, and then they're no longer projections. And that's what spiritual practice, at least Zen, is all about, is being able to see these notions that we overlay on people and things, and to see them for what they are, notions that we've picked up, we've acquired and fostered in our lives. Because the one thing we want to do is to see things as they are and not through these projections. I'm going to pluck out a few more passages here. Buddha says it is like when a magician uses materials such as plants and wood and tiles and stone to create an illusion and conjures the appearance of different creatures, which then gives rise to different projections, but projections that are not real. And then Red Pine comments, and often I found his commentaries very useful, because he would be able to, in our own modern language, very simply summarize or clarify what the Buddha was saying in different kind of more archaic language. Here Red Pine says, just as a magician fabricates forms that people imagine as being what they are not, thus does our repository consciousness produce our world of objects as well as our sensory bodies, both of which we imagine to be real, out of the seeds of habit energy from past projections that we once more imagine as being what they are not. Here's an interesting thing I'd never heard of till I read this sutra, a concept called the three modes of reality. And these are an imagined reality, a dependent reality, and a perfected reality. And then Red Pine says the three modes do not refer to separate realities. They simply represent the three ways we perceive what is real. And here are the three. In imagined reality, we mistakenly perceive things as separate from other things. Okay, we talked about that, name and form, name and appearance. In dependent reality, we correctly perceive things as dependent on other things, but we still perceive the world in terms of things which are themselves fictions. So this is the doctrine of interdependence. We see everything, no thing standing apart from any other thing, but everything is interdependent or interpenetrating. So this is better than just seeing things as separate. But still, it's still, we're caught in the fiction of our perceptions. And he says, in perfected reality, we neither perceive nor do not perceive things, for things neither exist nor do not exist. In perfected reality, we dwell in the realm of the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of the Buddhas, or means the storehouse consciousness in its essentially pure state. And then the self. This is the Buddha about the self. Of course, the self is just another illusion. It's another projection of our mind. The self is a separate entity. Here's what he says. What does it mean that beings have no self? The assemblage of the skandhas are the five constituents of what we call a self. Okay, we got a little more time. Here's what helped me understand the skandhas for many, many years, even though since I was 22 years old, I've been chanting the Prajnaparamita, where we say that saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. I never could quite understand these five skandhas, and in one of our discussion groups in the Three Jewels Order, I found I wasn't the only one who had trouble getting my mind around these five skandhas. The five are, to use our chanting version, form, feeling, thought, and choice, and consciousness. And then, as I drove by the East Avenue Wegmans when it was being demolished, the Wegmans itself, but that parcel of a couple blocks of property that they are now expanding into, it was a series of four or five retail stores, outlets, that Wegmans bought up. And then the first thing they did toward expanding the East Avenue Wegmans into a superstore, first thing they had to do was demolish, take away those five old, decrepit retail outlets. And so we saw these buildings as I would drive by sometimes with my wife. It started with just the, let's say, I don't remember the order of things. Let's say they started with taking apart some of the outer structure. And you could see, okay, we still would call that a building. There was one building more prominent than the other four. And then they would take off some more. Maybe the roof at a certain point. Okay, we still see that as a building. There's the word, building. But then at a certain point, it had been dismantled enough that we couldn't call it a building anymore. It was just some couple of structures, posts and maybe a couple of beams. And now there was so much daylight in there, there was so much space that, okay, it's no longer a building. Well, this is the nature of the self, that what we call the self just has these elements. Form, that's the appearance or the physicality of it. Feeling, the ability to feel or sensation, and thought and the others. So that's a 1 minute kind of analogy of what skandhas mean. But in fact, there is no self apart from these five elements, just as there's no building, in quotes, what we call a building, there's no building apart from just these different elements, the beams, the siding, the roof, and so forth. We just put them all together and we call it a building or a self. So he says, the assemblage of the skandhas arises from ignorance, karma, and desire, and includes neither a self nor anything that belongs to a self. As the grasping and attachment of such senses as the eye to form give rise to consciousness, so when the eye sees a form, and this gives rise to consciousness, bodies, houses, and the world of objects that our perceptions of one's own mind are fabricated and manifested from one's own projections. They change and disappear every moment, like a river or a seed or a candle or the wind or a cloud. Restless like a monkey, attracted to impurities like a fly, and you know what that means, and insatiable like a wind-blown fire, they move like a water wheel through life after life and bodily form after bodily form, impelled by habit energy without beginning, like figures produced by some sort of magic trick or spell or mechanical device. To be skilled in the knowledge of such appearances means to know that beings have no self. But in Zen, that discovery, that realization of the no self, isn't done through analogies or logic anything like that, but through a sudden awakening. But really, every time we're doing Zazen, awakened or not, every time we do Zazen and we see what flux the mind is it gets harder and harder as we go on through the years to accept that there is some kind of permanent entity in there, when all we see is the flow of thoughts and images and feelings and so forth. And then it's not that the enlightened don't see the same world as the unenlightened. It's that what we want to do is to recognize that this world of appearances is not true in any ultimate sense. We still move through it in the same way, but realize that it is projections. And he talks about delusions here. He says, delusions also appear to the wise, but they aren't confused by them. All of this this thing about the illusory nature of what we call reality made me think back to a fascinating book that I made a couple teishos out of actually many years ago, called The User Illusion. And it's, I don't know, I may be stretching it too much, but I think it's really, they're talking about the same thing. The idea, well, here it is very basically, that he says here, and this is a book, international bestseller from maybe 10 years ago, by Tor Nuretranders, a Norwegian neuroscientist and author, who makes the following points based on what was at the time the latest in neuroscience, is that through our senses, we are receiving such tremendous amount of data that never becomes conscious to us, that we have to configure reality based on our best guess from all this. So there is this, what has been called a reducing valve, that we use to, as the subtitle says, cutting consciousness down to size. That we have, what is it here? Some fantastic amount of data that's coming in. We take in 11 million bits per second of information that we take in through our senses, and of course we could never deal with such a tidal wave of that if we made it all conscious. So most of it remains unconscious, and on the basis of that, we construct a kind of reality that we call reality. He compares it to computers, that the person using the computer has no idea about all the workings of it and all its minutia, but you just have the different keys with the different letters and things on it that we use that handles it for us. So we reduce it to something that's user-friendly. We don't need to know all the data, just what we need. And he compares consciousness to that. The user illusion, he says, is the picture the user has of the machine. He says, there are no colors, sounds, or smells out there in the world. They are things we experience. This does not mean that there is no world, for indeed there is. The world just is. It has no properties until it is experienced, or at least not properties like color, smell, and sound. So, ultimately then, it's all of this rests on the delusion that there is a world out there apart from the experiencer of the world, that there is an object, a world of an objective world that can be separated from the subjective, from the subjective observer. All right, we've reached our mark, so we're going to stop now and recite the four vows.